Hello, welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme and podcast for teachers, policymakers, and anyone with an interest in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. What if everything you knew about education was wrong? Is the provocative title of a book on education by David Dido. David Dido is a teacher and author about education, and his other books are titled The Secret Literacy and What Every Teacher Needs to Know About Psychology. But the one that first caught my attention was the one that encourages us to question what we know about education. It has chapters on The Problem with Praise, The Dark Art of Differentiation, and Why Lesson Observation Doesn't Work. I travelled to Bristol to meet up with David, and I'll bring you my interview with him on the programme this week and next week. I first asked David to tell me about his understanding of the purpose of teaching.
I have a sort of quite clear idea in my own mind that the purpose of education is to make children cleverer. And so therefore, teaching is about trying to find means and mechanisms for increasing the intellectual capacity and capability of students. And I think that having a sort of clarity of purpose like that makes it a lot easier to think about what one ought to be doing at any sort of given point. If it doesn't have a relationship to making that increase, then it's probably not likely to be that useful.
So when you say making children cleverer,
yeah,
how does that relate to the curriculum at school today? So, I mean, you want them to be cleverer in maths, you want them to be cleverer in English language,
yes,
and so on. Is that the idea?
Yes, essentially, because cleverness is a sort of global idea of intelligence as a global attribute isn't something that's particularly malleable or subject to increase, whereas increasing one's cognitive ability within a particular domain, like, as you say, maths or language arts, is relatively straightforward. Essentially, the more you know about a subject, the more you can think, and the more you can think, not just about, but with, then the cleverer you are.
Really then, it is about being a better thinker.
Yes, but I don't see thinking as a generic skill. Thinking is domain specific. Nobody can think about something they don't know. I mean, you can try that at home if you like. It's not a very fulfilling experience. You can think about things you don't know much about, but you're limited to saying things like, oh, what's quantum physics? Whereas if you know an awful lot about, say, quantum physics, then you can have really rich, fulfilling thoughts and ideas and ponderings concerned with that. But that doesn't transfer to history of art or cooking or skateboarding or anything else. You've got to know about these things in order to think about them.
So acquiring knowledge then is a prerequisite for becoming cleverer.
Yes. There's a very, very clear connection between knowing things, but that's broader and more and more substantial than factual knowledge. So I think all kinds of knowledge are equally as important to be able to think. So to give an example of that, people are often very dismissive of children, sort of the metaphor that's always used is regurgitating facts and sort of, you know, what's the point in sort of knowing when the Battle of Hastings was or you know, when the American War of Independence ended,
Or you can just Google it.
Or you can just look it up. Yeah, exactly that. Whereas, I mean, obviously, you can just Google things, and Google's, you know, the internet is fantastic, but in order to make sense of things that you look up, you have to know a substantial amount about them. Otherwise, you end up with children just copying and pasting into their homework and with no understanding at all of the information that they've discovered. A really good example of a domain of knowledge which is vital to success in education is knowing how to read. I think a lot of people see reading as a skill that you can either do or you can't do, or you can do with a degree of facility or you're just not very good at. And I don't think that's right. I think the ability to read is utterly, entirely dependent on what you know. So anyone who can read English has, whether they're aware of it or not, they have memorised all of the phoneme grapheme relationships that make up English words. So there's over 44 different phonemes represented by over 170 different graphemes, sounds to letter representations. In order to read, you've memorised those. They are at your fingertips. So you don't even have to think about them. And that allows you then to think about meaning and substance. But also your ability to make sense of the sounds that you can decode depends upon your knowledge of vocabulary and your knowledge of the world. So I can take somebody who can score very, very highly in a reading test and give them some reading material and then give them a comprehension test and guarantee that they do really, really badly at it if I give them something I know they know nothing about.
So if we go back to the idea of becoming cleverer, yeah. Then how do we circumscribe, or how do we select the domains in which we want students to become cleverer?
Well, to my mind, this is why subjects are a very useful construct. These are often sort of spoken of in quite sort of dismissive terms by various people in education as being sort of silos of knowledge and preventing people from sort of cross-fertilising ideas. But actually, the subject disciplines, many of them have been around for hundreds of years, and there's a tradition and a body and a disciplinary way of thinking which has grown up surrounding these subjects, which enables people to think well when they know a lot about the subjects. I mean, one of the things that I sort of talk about in my writing is one of the big problems with education is transfer, that we teach children to do things and they can do them in the context that we've taught them, and then they come across them in some slightly different context and they can't then apply the things that we thought they had mastered in a slightly different related area.
So if the job of schools and of teaching is to make children cleverer, how good a job are schools doing at making children cleverer?
Not as well as they could. And this, obviously, lots of people are going to disagree with my view on this, but because I don't think the majority of people who work in schools would share my belief, I think they think that schools are for other things, so they don't prioritise this stuff, and so they don't ensure children are made cleverer by education. And the things, perhaps, that they do value don't happen because they miss out this essential step. So, I mean, I'm really fascinated by the construct of intelligence as a psychological tool to understand the human mind, and it's flawed and it's incomplete. But the correlational studies which show links between IQ scores and pretty much every other desirable trait suggest that if you want people to be happier, healthier, to make better moral choices, to live longer, to have better mental health, or to self-report having greater happiness, all of these things are improved if you make people cleverer. Whereas if you just try and go straight for those things, it doesn't work. I mean, it's well-intentioned, just doesn't happen. Or the extent to which it does happen, I think what happens is that a lot of the way in which education is practiced privileges the already privileged and disadvantages the disadvantaged. Whereas if you take an approach that education is about making all children cleverer, then you flatten that as far as possible.
You also have spoken, at least before, about how the education system overemphasizes the how of what teachers do and underemphasizes the why they do what they do. Could you just say a little bit more about that?
When I say how there, I think that certainly in my experience, there's a preoccupation with pedagogy, like how does one teach X? What are the different ways that you could teach this concept, this idea, this way of thinking? How do you get children to master this set of ideas? And that's interesting to a point and to a degree. I think that's less interesting than what. So what children learn, I think, is far, far more important than how they learn it. What we teach is far more important than how we teach it.
But if you're focusing on the what teachers teach, isn't that really out of teachers' control? Because that's usually prescribed by a curriculum or a department or the people who run the schools.
Well, is it? I don't know. In the UK, we have quite a lot of central control, far more than in some other areas, where there is a national curriculum, which to a large degree is prescribed. But teachers mediate that. There's a really neat idea that comes from economics called opportunity cost. So the idea of opportunity cost is that typically we'd evaluate the success of our practice by thinking, how did that go? Did that go well? and we look around, we look at the children, we look to check whether they're engaged or whatever it is, and we go, yeah, it's gone pretty well. What we don't do is to think about the opportunity cost of what we did, which requires that we weigh the course of action that we chose against another course of action that we didn't choose. And I find that very, very useful for thinking about things like what, like the curriculum. So I chose to teach, for instance, this young adult novel, which I thought the children would really, really enjoy. But that meant, because time is finite, that I couldn't teach another text which had perhaps richer, more powerful knowledge about the world, greater range of vocabulary for them to learn and to get access to. And so I might well think on first glance that what I taught went well, but what if it wasn't as good or as valuable or as important as the choice I didn't take? And that's a choice that teachers have every single lesson. Imagine you're a history teacher and you're teaching, I don't know, like the Battle of the Somme to a bunch of 13-year-olds. So in a slightly artificial way, let's say you've got three choices. Your first choice would be to give them an article on to read on the Battle of the Somme, which gave them all sorts of background knowledge and vocabulary. But, you know, that's a bit boring and the children might go, oh, I don't really fancy this. So what you could do instead is you could go on YouTube and you could find a little fun documentary which contained much of the same facts and information, and you could show that instead. Or the third option might be, let's do some sort of fun activity where we get the children walking around the room, we get them sort of, you know, searching for, we've hidden sort of chunks of information around the room, they have to go and find it for themselves, and they'll love that, they'll think that's a lot of fun, and they'll think the teacher's a legend. And as an individual teacher, I really understand why a lot of teachers would go for that last choice, because you've got the kids on sides, they think you're great, it's fun. The first option, I can really understand why that's the least attractive option for a lot of teachers, but that is the one I would suggest is going to be of most value to the students and to every other teacher within a community. That if children get lots of practice at reading challenging material mediated by a teacher, then that's going to best prepare them for whatever they're likely to come across next. So in that way, I'm not saying that one choice is right and one's wrong, and I think there might be very legitimate reasons why today, actually, you know, I've got this class, they're a bit tricky, I want to build my relationship with them, I want to get a sense of, you know, that history is fun. Let's choose option three. But it's a choice. Every single lesson is a choice. You choose what you're going to teach, as well as how you're going to teach it. And so although somebody more senior to you might have made a decision about this is the curriculum, you mediate that every day.
So how then can teachers be educated to be aware of these choices that they're making on a daily basis in their classrooms?
Well, slightly disingenuously, you know, teachers can be educated in the same way that children can be educated. And maybe there's a lesson for us to think about the way in which we do teacher education. Maybe we focus on the wrong things in the wrong way. If I take my own experience here, my teacher education was very much about sort of, here's a set of assumptions which we're not going to examine. We're not going to do any critical thinking about. We're just going to assume that these tenets are correct, and then we're going to send you off and test you on how well you meet these assumptions. To my mind, that's a very poor way to educate teachers. I think that whatever your ideological beliefs might be, and as you know, I'm sure there's people who are going to disagree with me on what my beliefs are, but I think it's always best to have teachers who are taught professional scepticism. They're taught to not take assumptions and to think critically and to try and unpick ideas and to pull strands and to ask awkward questions. And I think unless you encourage that in teachers, then you get compliant, thoughtless, ill-conceived stuff being perpetuated.
But the other side of that is, if we were talking, say, about preparing medical doctors, for example. You might say you want them to be skeptical, but at the same time, you know, you don't want them to be going in and to be conducting surgery in an innovative way. You know, I mean, you want them to kind of to go with the tried and trusted.
Yes, you do.
So why is teaching different then, that people should be making it up almost on an individual basis?
Taking the example that you've given there of medicine, up until relatively recently, doctors very much behaved in that kind of way of doing whatever they thought was best. The whole idea of education research is highly contested. There are, you know, there's a real strand of postmodern thinking which denies the idea that science can ever find any kind of answer to the best way to teach or how children might learn. And it rejects that notion completely. Can you imagine doctors taking that approach? You know, that I reject the idea that science can evaluate whether or not this drug is better than that one. Yeah, you know, it would be a nightmare, and people would be dropping like flies. So you go back far enough, you know, you go back to a pre-scientific idea of medicine, when doctors pretty much all believed in the four humours. And so treating a patient was about balancing a patient's humours, which is why they did bloodletting, because they wanted to make sure they didn't have too much spleen or cholera or whatever it was. So they'd cut them and they'd bleed them. And you could imagine a conversation with a doctor where you said, how do you know that bloodletting, putting a leech on a patient is a successful way to treat them? And they might go, well, look at all these people that I've saved. And if you were to say to them, but what about all these people that haven't survived, all of these dead bodies? They go, hey, you know, you can't cure everyone. Things happen. And I think teachers are very much like that. Like, for instance, how do you know that spending hours of your time marking children's books is an effective way to use your time? Well, look at all these children who've got great exam results. Okay, but what about the ones that haven't? Oh, you can't do anything about those. And we're like medieval doctors. We really are. We're going with this sense of, I know what's best for me and my students, and damn anyone who comes along with the hubris and the arrogance to suggest that they know something that I don't know. And I think that's something that really needs challenging. We need to balance this idea of professional scepticism against professional humility.
I came across your work, David, when I found your book called What If Everything You Knew About Education Was Wrong? So if I do the opposite of that, first of all, who do you trust about matters related to education?
Trust is earned. So I trust people who I've been sceptical about, and I've thought a lot about what they've said or the source has said, and as yet I've no reason to doubt them. But I don't think anyone should just be trusted. Nobody should trust me. You know, I think everybody should have the starting point of dismissing me as a fool and a charlatan and trying to break my thinking and my ideas. And only if they can't should they then start to say, well, maybe cautiously we should accept some of this stuff. So some years ago I read the work of a cognitive scientist called Daniel Willingham, and he wrote a wonderfully titled book called Why Don't Students Like School? And he broke down lots of, in a very sort of simple, accessible way, a lot of the thinking from cognitive science about how children learn and what implications this might have for teachers. And when I first read it, I was very challenged a lot of my existing notions, and I was quite sceptical of some of the things it was suggesting, and I've spent some years thinking about and trying to integrate this stuff into my way of thinking. So Daniel Willingham, over time, over some years, has become a trusted source. I correspond with him, and when he suggests avenues that I ought to sort of look at or sends me a piece of research and says it's worth thinking about, I'm minded to take that seriously. But one of the things that, for me, makes him trustworthy is that he caveats everything. He says might. He says this might be useful. This could be a beneficial approach. And so as a shorthand heuristic for trusting people, anyone who says this is right, distrust them. They are automatically wrong. Because there's no such thing as always right. This is the right way to do things. There's a lot of snake oil salesmen. There's a lot of people that are trying to make money out of education, and they've got a vested interest in saying, this is correct. I've tried to engineer my professional stance to sort of almost monetize the idea of doubt. So I've always got an escape hatch, so that I always say, look, this is what I think is right. If I find out that I'm mistaken, I will be the first person to put my hand up and say, no, I was wrong about that. I regularly put up blogs where I go, no, look, I've made a few mistakes about something, or here's some new information which gives me cause to doubt stuff I've said previously. And that's what we should be looking for in sources to see who's trustworthy. People who are prepared to say that they're wrong.
And where then do you think teachers are picking up several what you would think are wrong ideas about education?
Well, some of them are just, you know, they're like urban myths. They're just in the water, like, and it just becomes received wisdom. So I think there's a lot of that. And there's a
Is
lot
that
of
from growing up in a particular culture, you imbibe certain ideas?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case.
What ideas are you thinking of there?
Well, there's a couple of really big underlying ideas in Western culture, which are sort of romanticism and enlightenment thinking. And romanticism sort of exemplifies the idea that nature, what's natural, is good. If it's natural, if it's green, if it's organic, it's automatically good. And so you've only got to sort of frame things in a, you know, this is what children naturally do, for teachers to nod along and go, oh, well, it must be right if that's what they know. It doesn't take a lot of critical thinking to say, if we really value what was natural, we'd all be hunter-gatherers. So we haven't really thought that through if we're unthinkingly accepting that. And then the Enlightenment sort of tropes come from the idea that science can provide an answer to everything. And that's not true either. And so, you know, you look at things like shampoo adverts where they have sort of some jargon. And they're even sort of in a postmodern way, they even say, here comes the science bit. No, trust us, because there's some science. I read some research a while back which said if you put a picture of a brain scan in an article, people are much more inclined to trust its veracity than if you don't include that picture. So we're susceptible to that sort of thing. Science is a very useful tool for working out probabilities. It has nothing to say on what we should value.
And what kind of ideas in education do you see are wrong but are widely believed?
Well, it's almost unfashionable to talk about it now because people regularly debunk the idea of learning styles. But there's continued research which suggests that a majority of teachers believe that you ought to teach students according to their preferred learning style, and that by doing so you'll improve their outcomes. There isn't a shred of evidence to support that, but it's really persuasive. It's truthy. And we all sort of instinctively recognise that we do have preferences. So people say to me regularly, yeah, but I am a visual learner, I much prefer to see things, or I much prefer to be kinesthetic. And my response to that is to say, I'm not really interested what your preferences are. My preference is that I learn with a nice espresso coffee and a small piece of dark chocolate, but yeah, that I'd much rather do it like that. But of course I can learn in lots of other ways, that how we learn is much more aligned with content than it is with our preference. So for instance, if I was working with a class of children and I wanted them to understand what the shape of the continent of Africa looked like, my best bet is to show them all a picture. That no one, no matter what their idea of their preference is best going to learn that by, you know, me getting them to, I don't know, walk out the shape of the continent on the classroom floor or to read a description of the coastline. Everyone will best understand it visually. If I want somebody to learn how to play the piano, the most effective way to do that is to be kinesthetic. I can show you a video or I can explain it, but you've got to use your hands, otherwise there's no chance. And so you match the mode of instruction to the content. There are obvious exceptions. So obviously if I'm showing you a picture of Africa and you're blind, then no matter what your preference is, that's not going to work because you can't see the image. But that's a gross physical difference. That's not a preference. That's something else.
Where then should teachers look to for ideas about education and teaching?
I think that's really hard. In the UK, we have a government-funded website called the Education Endowment Foundation, and they have a toolkit which gives schools advice on what strategies are most likely to be effective in trying to close the gap between the least advantaged and most advantaged students. They've looked at various different aspects of education. So, for instance, they've looked at the effects of ability setting, or they've looked at literacy programs, digital technology, and they've tried to crunch an awful lot of research. Then they provide a top hits chart of the things which are most likely to be effective and the things which are least likely to be effective. Even that has problems. I mean, it's a very well-intentioned approach. It's much better than not having it, but the way in which the information's presented ends up with people misinterpreting very subtle, difficult, nuanced ideas. So, for instance, when they started, one of their headlines was that teaching assistants are a waste of money. They make no difference. They're hugely expensive. They make no difference, by and large, to children's education. So maybe we shouldn't have them. And that's how it was interpreted by lots and lots of people. Oh, maybe we should get rid of teaching assistants. Maybe we don't need them. And actually, it was a bit more complex than that. That you had to think a lot more critically about that and think, well, maybe the sorts of children who are working with an assistant, maybe they're the people who are the least likely to make progress anyway. Maybe instead it added qualitatively to their experience of school in a way which isn't captured in results. And maybe we should be a little bit more nuanced in our thinking. But what we shouldn't do is have a knee-jerk response and go, let's sack teaching assistants. But people are tempted because they're desperate for certainty. And I think that, for me, the big enemy in all of this is the idea that there are answers, that there is certainty, that you can always do X and it will always give you Y. And I really understand why people want to be certain, because they want to do the right thing. But the problem is that as soon as you are certain, as soon as you think you know the answer, you stop thinking, you stop being open, you close down and you become dogmatic, trying to maintain uncertainty and scepticism and doubt and to say, well, we're going to pursue this course of action, but we're going to be really cautious. We're going to evaluate it carefully. And if we think that we might have made a mistake, we're going to acknowledge that. And setting out those kinds of things from the outset, we might be wrong. We need to find out because we don't know, means that you're much more likely to evaluate something honestly than if you say, this is the right thing to do, we're going to invest all our time and money in this. Then there's huge vested interest which prevents you from seeing the results honestly.
And the virtue that lies behind uncertainty was expressed by David Dido, and it brings this week's Inside Education to a close. David Dido's book is called What If Everything You Knew About Education Was Wrong? And I'll bring you more of my interview with David on next week's programme. To download over 300 Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com and click on the Podcasts tab. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from all good online bookshops and from libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.